Why don't you get a copy of the outline? If you need one, wave your hand. Brother Spidle brought those with him down here. He can get one to you. Coming to the conclusion of the book of Esther tonight. Persian Empire, 6th century BC. Xerxes is the king. He was emperor. Jews have been threatened with annihilation. A royal official named Haman, just to recap, I know you know the story, but a royal official named Haman, evidently descended from the ancient Amalekite king Agag, had maneuvered Xerxes into approving the extermination of all the Jews throughout the empire. And it was in the 14th year of Xerxes' reign. The extermination was to occur on the 13th day of the 12th month. Kind of a countdown there, almost. The 14th year, 13th day, 12th month of Xerxes' reign that this extermination was to occur. But through the subtle manipulation of events in the background, God, who remains unmentioned in the text, he had already arranged some years previously to have Esther, the Jewess, otherwise unknown, whose given name was Hadassah, had her named and elevated to be queen at the urging of her cousin and guardian Mordecai. She had not revealed her identity as a Jewess until such time as this plot comes to pass. And so Mordecai urged her at that point to confront Xerxes, let him know, reveal to him her identity as a Jew, and Haman's evil plot to kill her and all of her people and see if she couldn't get something done about it. And as a result, Haman was executed by impaling. Mordecai was elevated to Grand Vizier. He took Haman's place, was empowered by Xerxes then to write a new edict. Nullify the earlier edict, but he could counteract it somehow if he could come up with a way to do that. He wrote a new edict allowing the Jews to organize for their own defense against their enemies. Mostly defensive, although clearly offensive when they got an extra day to kill their enemies in the capital. This edict was disseminated 9 months in advance of the scheduled date of the Jewish genocide. When that day arrived, the end result was the Jews were triumphant over their enemies. And they wiped out their enemies throughout the empire, all those who attacked them. And in the capital, were given an extra day to take care of those enemies that they had there in the capital city. Another 300 died on the second day. And as a result, in the provinces and even in the capital, the Jews spontaneously celebrated this great victory that God had given them with feasting and with gifts. And the record could have ended right there, chapter 9, verse 18, which is where we were last time. That's where the record could have stopped, but it doesn't. It goes on. I've called this section an epilogue, but that kind of understates the significance of what remains here. This is not just some extra stuff to kind of summarize and tell you, and so they lived happily ever after, and here's what happened. That's not what this is about. The nature of what remains identifies the entire narrative as something that would be called by linguists or literary critics or analysts an etiological story. That is, a story told or a narrative told to explain the historic establishing of an annual event. It'd be like teaching kids today the story of the pilgrims leading up to Thanksgiving. As an explanation, you can tell them the story of the pilgrims, but it becomes an ideological story when the whole point is to explain the purpose of Thanksgiving. Well, that's what this is for the Jews. It's a story explaining a holiday that they're going to be celebrating henceforth. Evidently, everything that's gone before was recorded for the express purpose that future generations of Jews would know why they celebrate the Feast of Purim annually. Chapter 9 explains the institutionalization of this annual feast to commemorate their triumph. Chapter 10 gives you just a 3-verse summary of the future career of Mordecai. So I've called it an epilogue, but it's kind of more than just an epilogue. And so we'll read the text as we go in small sections. Let's ask the Lord to bless our study tonight. Father, as we come to your word this evening, we ask that you would bless it and bless your word to our hearts. Open our hearts and minds to understand the truth and to see the significance of it. But Lord, help us to see you revealed in your word for our instruction and encouragement. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the opening section, the rest of chapter 9, is establishing an annual holiday. Establishing an annual holiday. And so in the first few verses, verses 20 to 25, are some instructions, the instruction from Mordecai. The text says, it doesn't tell us where Mordecai wrote these events, but just tells us that he does. Verse 20, then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far. Now, I called him Xerxes when I was summarizing the beginning. That's what the Greeks called him. Ahasuerus was an Aramaic spelling of his Persian name. His Persian name is, I would say, unpronounceable. Somebody can probably pronounce it. I can't with any confidence. Okay. It says that Mordecai recorded these events. And commentators frequently, many commentators say we should not assume that that means Mordecai wrote this book. But I'm not sure what else we're supposed to assume, to tell you the truth. If he wrote these events and recorded all these events, I'm not sure where he recorded them if it's not this book, and I'm not sure who wrote this book if he didn't. I think the implication is that Mordecai wrote this book. That's how the Jews have traditionally understood that statement in this text. I qualified that just a little and said perhaps Mordecai wrote this book because most commentators say that that statement doesn't mean necessarily that he wrote the book. They're kind of distancing themselves from the traditional view for reasons I don't fully understand. I would hesitate to say categorically that proves he wrote it. It doesn't necessarily, but I think it strongly implies that that's where this book came from. Mordecai is the one who had kept this record and who provided it for us. I suspect we should understand him to have been the author of this book. But it also tells us in this verse that he used the postal system there in that existed there in Persia, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces, both near and far. That's, again, a pretty comprehensive statement. And within that letter, the next two verses, three verses, explain what it is that letter said. What summarizes it. Obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same month annually, because on those days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies, and it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Thus, the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. Right? He commanded, what that's saying basically is that he commanded them to celebrate this Feast of Purim, he hasn't called it that yet, to celebrate this feast annually. The celebration that was so spontaneous on the day after your victory, let's do this every year. That's the directive from the capital, from the Grand Vizier. Mordecai wrote to and sent it everywhere throughout the kingdom that next year and every year thereafter, we're going to make this celebration. The 14th and the 15th, a two-day event in perpetuity. It specified that it was to be celebrated with feasting. He told the details of how they're supposed to do it. He says feasting, rejoicing, which is personal joy, gratitude to God for what he's done, sending food to one another, and that's emphasizing the community relationship with among the Jews. And then he also talks of giving gifts to the poor. That's looking out for the needs of others. Now, this gift giving is kind of something like what we do at Christmas, but there's a difference. This is not exchanging gifts with one another. This is providing gifts to the poor. In fact, the rabbinical writings, the Talmud specifies that at Purim, celebrants are to take gifts to at least two poor people who take something to help at least two different poor people. That's part of what they were to do as a part of this celebration, as had been laid down by Mordecai when he established this holiday with this letter. It had been spontaneous. Now he's making it tradition, establishing it as something that would be added to the Jewish calendar annually. And it was to commemorate their victory over their enemies, number three. To commemorate their victory over their enemies. Because at this time, on these days, they were to remember that this was a month that would have been a month that we would have been fasting and mourning the great tragedy of the slaughter of most or all of our people. If any of us remained, that would have been the memory. The slaughter of most or all of our people. But instead, it's turned into a time of gladness and celebration. And so verse 23 tells us that they did that, that they undertook to do exactly what he said. So it's looking ahead, at least a year, two, 3 years down the road, probably several years, that they did in fact continue to celebrate this. We know they did because they continue to today. Now verses 24 and 25 may actually be the text of the letter. What we've had here is a summation of what the letter's point was, its purpose. Verses 24 and 25, many believe, is actually at least an extract from the letter. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme which he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. That's probably a portion of that letter that he sent. Haman's casting Pur, and he uses both the Persian word Pur, which is a singular for casting lots. Lots in the plural is Purim. He cast Pur, and then he uses the Hebrew word, or the lot, to determine what day all this would occur. Haman's casting Pur to destroy the Jews had been overturned, he says, to his and his family's destruction. What he had intended to do to the Jews, God did to him. Although he didn't use God's name. It had been overturned so that this fell on Haman and his family instead of on God's people. Now, how best to translate the expression that starts verse 25, when it came to the king's attention? There's disagreement on that because of the pronoun, it. In the Hebrew, the pronoun it is in the feminine. The New American Standard, the English Standard Version, the New International Version, all interpret it as a neuter pronoun and say it, when it came to his attention. As a reference to the entire situation, Haman's plot, what was intended for the Jews, and Esther's and Mordecai's relationship to what Haman had in view when it came to his attention. And so they interpret it that way, and it may be that's the best way to understand it. The Holman Christian Standard and the Net Bible do something similar. They substitute the pronoun for the expression the matter, when the matter came to his attention. However, other translations have handled it differently. The Revised Standard Version, the New American Bible, which is a Catholic version, not to be confused with the New American Standard, but the Revised Standard Version, the New American Bible, both say when she came to his attention, because it's a feminine pronoun. The King James actually supplies Esther's name, which isn't found in the text here, as an attempt to clarify it, using the she as the feminine pronoun as the basis for that. When Esther, and the idea there being that it was when Esther brought this matter to the king's attention, when he acknowledged her presence and heard her out and she intervened, that's when things changed. That's probably the better way to read this, because it does use the feminine pronoun. However, it really doesn't make a great deal of difference which one, because they're all talking about the same event, right? Whether he's talking about the situation came to his attention or whether he's talking about the person who brought that to the king's attention, the end result is the same. So from a practical point of view, it doesn't make a great deal of difference. Anyway, that's just a little issue that could have come up as you're reading that. If you're reading the King James, it says when Esther... use Esther's name there. How come it says here when it came? That's why. The point is that what Mordecai was saying in his letter, and what he's saying here in this record, is that Haman intended to kill the Jews. Esther brought it to the king's attention. When the king recognized what was going on, he put a stop to it. And it was overturned to our benefit, to our aid, the aid of the Jews. And so what was the reaction of the Jews in verses 26 to 28? Therefore, they called these days Purim after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in the letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews, or their memory fade from their descendants. First of all, they named the holiday Purim, which is an odd name. And as I said at the beginning of this study into the book of Esther, it argues very strongly for the historic reliability of this account. This is a word the Jews would not have used. Had this not been written during this era, had that holiday not originated during this era, they would have called it something else. They would not have used this word for the lots. It's a Persian word, and they've adopted that Persian name for it because Haman cast lots for this day he thought would be so auspicious, and it turned around on him. And the whole point for their sakes, from the Jewish point of view, is that by naming this holiday after something that seems to be an uncontrollable random event, like throwing dice. The point is, God's controlling even those things. Even something that seems so random as a roll of the dice. God had his hand upon it. The unseen guidance of divine providence through events you can't control and nobody could have anticipated. And so that's the name for the holiday. They established the holiday for both the Jews and converts. It says, for all those who allied themselves with them. Mentioned before that there were many who came to their support, who became, I believe the text indicates that they became Jews by conversion, as it were. It wasn't a false conversion. It was that they were terrified of what God was going to do and what would have happened to them, and they came to faith in the Lord. And so they had allied themselves with them, and so they are going to be participants in this as well. This is not exclusively Hebrew in its celebration. It is Jewish, but it's also those who were from other ethnic groups who had joined them, those from other nations that had joined them. And there were many during this, at the time of this event. And so they were going to be included as kind of Jews by spiritual adoption. That's a concept with which we're familiar in the New Testament, isn't it? There seems to be the way they're thinking here. The constant use of wording here that implies or indicates the intent that this would be permanent. You notice over and over again, it says they established and made a custom in verse 27, first part of verse 27, for themselves and their descendants to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation. The days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants in verse 28. Then it says that everyone was intended to participate, every family, every province, every city. This isn't just for a few of us. This is for everybody. This is something we expect everybody to do. This isn't just if you feel like it. It isn't just if you have time. This is something we need to do to recognize what God has done for us. Again, God's name isn't mentioned, but they expect everybody to participate, and they expect everybody to do it from now on. That was Mordecai's. That's what Mordecai intended in this letter. So as I said for number three, they intended every Jew to participate and every generation to remember. Every Jew to participate and every generation to remember. Don't forget what God has done here for us. And it's still celebrated today on dates that shift on our calendar. It moves around. Generally, the dates range somewhere between February 25th and March 25th. You know what the date for Purim is this year? Tomorrow, March 9th. And so they always start with a day of fasting, which would be today. And then they would begin their celebration. You know, the Jews start their day at dusk, right? They'll be starting their celebration about the time we head home. The actual feasting and celebrating. It would be today, or last night and today, that they would be meeting in their synagogues, and I'll tell you a little more about how they would do that in just a minute. But again, I didn't plan it that way. I had intended to finish Esther a few weeks ago when I first laid all this out, but different things have occurred, and it got delayed, and as I was checking the dates, and I'm going to find out when Purim is celebrated, I said, you got to be kidding. It's the 9th. It's tomorrow. They'll be celebrating. Right, this is on the Jewish mind right now. In verses 29 to 32, we have a confirmation letter that comes from Esther. The confirmation from Esther. It says, "And then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail," first time he's mentioned, "with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. He sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times, just as Mordecai the Jew and Esther Queen and Queen Esther had established for them, and just as they had established for themselves and for their descendants with instructions for their times of fasting and their lamentations. The command of Esther was established. The command of Esther established these customs for Purim, and it was written in the book." So what Esther did here, apparently, and don't miss the honorific before her name. She is called here Queen Esther, once again, emphasizing her role in the kingdom. She wrote a second letter. This was a letter apparently co-signed by Mordecai, and it followed the letter that he had sent. And it was to show their unity on the matter. So that what she does with this letter, it adds the authority of the queen. And I'm not sure how much authority the queen was assumed to have, to tell you the truth. But, as I mentioned before, the king has already made her independently wealthy, which was rather unusual as well, by granting to her Haman's estate. And so how much influence a queen might normally have, I don't know, but by sending this letter along, she's underscoring the authority of Mordecai and adding the indicating that this is something that the crown supports. This isn't just Mordecai. He has full support of the crown. Addresses all the Jews in the empire. Now, the earlier letter went to all the Jews in all the provinces, which is comprehensive. This one specifically says 127 provinces, just in case you were counting. All 127 provinces, all of them. And it includes words of peace and truth. Peace and truth, an interesting expression to include here. Huey calls the first of these, he mentions that the first of these is one of the most theologically significant words in the Old Testament. It's the Hebrew word shalom. First time that word shows up in the Hebrew text is in Genesis when Abraham meets a rather mysterious priest by the name of Melchizedek, who was the priest of Shalom, okay, the priest of Salem, or the king of Salem, or Shalom, which may or may not have been what later become the Jebusite city that we know as Jerusalem, Shalom, all right, Jerusalem. But that word has a lot of theological significance. It can mean the absence of strife or the absence of conflict, as we often mean by peace, that there's been a resolution of discord. We have peace with God through Jesus Christ. But the word is broader than that. It includes, as Huey explains, the ideas of completeness or wholeness, harmony, fulfillment. The idea seems to be that she's writing to reassure the Jews throughout the kingdom that while Mordecai's letter that had come before had the full knowledge and the approval of the crown, that it accurately reflected royal intentions. The Jews didn't need to be afraid that there's a trick here. They didn't need to be afraid that there's something, that there's the rug going to be pulled out from under their feet, so to speak. This is a proclamation of the king's desire for peace for the Jews. Not just peace with the Jews, but that the Jews would be peaceful and at peace and prosper and feel whole. This is a statement of great blessing that was intended toward them, peace to the Jews. Verse 31 pretty much restates and summarizes 27 and 28. Did I read verse? All right, yeah, I read that section. Queen Esther, verse 31, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times. It's telling us the same thing that Mordecai's letter had. It kind of repeats that using many of the same statements. But this time, the difference between what Esther wrote in verse 31, she adds something that Mordecai hadn't included in the earlier letter. Mordecai talked about how everybody needs to memorialize the great triumph with feasting, sharing of food, gifts to the poor, and so on. Esther adds the idea of fasting and mourning here. Fasting and lamentation. That hadn't been included in the earlier instructions. Probably to memorialize the way the Jews responded initially to the word of Haman's edict. When the edict went out that said, on the 13th day of the 12th month, all members of the kingdom are called upon to rise up and annihilate the Jews. And to kill them all, annihilate, kill, destroy, all three words, and seize their property. When that came, when that word came, you remember how the Jews responded. There was wailing and mourning and fasting throughout the kingdom. And we're also told that Mordecai, outside the palace gate, because he couldn't come through the gate into the palace grounds in mourning wear, was sitting in sackcloth and ashes and mourning and fasting. Esther wasn't sure what was going on because she hadn't heard about the edict and had sent word to find out why is Mordecai so upset. He sent back and told her. That's when he told her what was going on, so she would go see the king. She said, look, before I go in there to see the king and risk my life, you organize the Jews in the capital. I'll get my staff with me, and we'll fast for 3 days. No food, no water for 3 days. At the end of that period, I'll go see the king, and if I die, I die. Well, Esther is apparently memorializing that fasting period as well. Not a 3-day period of fasting. That was unprecedented. But she's evidently memorializing that fast with a day of fasting prior to the days of feasting and celebration, which is why I said they've been fasting today for the celebration that starts tonight. They've been fasting for the last 24 hours. That was Esther's instruction that came in this second letter that she sent. So they start Purim a day early with fasting on the 13th of Adar and celebrate with feasting and gifts to the poor tomorrow. Now it says that this was written in the book. I don't know what book. Maybe it's the book of the records of the Persian kings, but it doesn't say what book. Maybe it's talking about this book, that her words were recorded here in this book as well for our instruction and benefit. Now, here's what Peter Stevenson says about the Jews celebrating Purim today. He says, on the day of the fast, the Jews meet in their synagogues, and they read the entire book of Esther. Each time the name Haman is spoken, the congregation stamps on the floor and says, let his name be blotted out, or cursed be Haman, or something like that. In fact, children often use noisemakers and rattles and stamp their feet to drown out Haman's name every time the name of Haman comes up. Because they're reading along, and when they see Haman's name coming, they stamp and make noise so nobody can hear the name of Haman, just to show their utter disdain for Haman. The name of Haman is often written on the soles of their shoes, probably in pencil, so that in stamping it, it's rubbed out by the end of the service. Okay, they really want to remember what Haman intended for them, and what God did to Haman in their defense. So that's something that's going on in the Jewish synagogues even now, as or was last night. I don't know whether it was last night or during the day today, in their commemoration of Purim. Now, as we move into chapter 10, and it's a very brief chapter, what we have here is a section extolling a national hero. If they were establishing an annual holiday in the closing verses of chapter 9, here they're extolling a national hero. And the book ends kind of like it started. Remember how the book opened? With a description of the greatness of King Ahasuerus? And here we have another description of the greatness of King Ahasuerus, but we're told why. And the contribution Mordecai made to the greatness of King Ahasuerus. As it says in verses 1 and 2, "Now King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia?" The greatness of Mordecai was preserved in the imperial chronicles. The point being that the king, in elevating Mordecai, did more to advance his own greatness than anything Haman could ever have done for him. Much of the credit for the greatness of King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, belongs to Mordecai. Persian emperors were constantly dealing with unrest throughout the empire. I mentioned that in the study of Ezra, and we'll go back to Ezra from here. But they had rebellions here and there. The collecting of tribute was always a chancy thing because people tended to resent having to send a large percentage of their produce or cash to the capital every year. And so he was always having to deal with problems here or there or wherever it might be, especially along the Mediterranean coast. Because they had access to markets without coming through Persian territory. They could ship things into Greek markets, okay? And he really didn't want to send things to the Greek markets. He really hated the Greeks. So what this text says is that Ahasuerus managed to impose tribute over all the land, including those remote coastlands along the Mediterranean, thanks largely to the work of his new grand vizier, Mordecai. Mordecai somehow managed to consolidate the nation, the kingdom, and the king's authority over the kingdom, and enriched the king by bringing in more tribute money than he had been collecting before. And so that 325 tons of silver that Haman had promised him, that was a pittance compared to what he had gained by having decided to disavow Haman's plan and move another direction and order the sparing of the Jews, as it were. The kingdom was enriched. The king's authority and strength throughout the empire was enhanced. Kind of in very much the same way that Joseph's administration in Egypt had strengthened Pharaoh. If you recall, it's been a long time since we studied in Genesis, but as a result of making Joseph grand vizier, Pharaoh ended up owning most of the property in Egypt. That had not been the case before Joseph. But people came needing food. Joseph had arranged to have foods provided and stored. So when they came needing food, they traded property for food to survive. And so Pharaoh became far more powerful as a result of Joseph's administration than he had ever been before. Than any king of Egypt had ever been prior to that. And something similar is going on right here with Mordecai in relation to the Persian king Ahasuerus or Xerxes. He increased the wealth and power of King Ahasuerus, as I put it for number one. He increased the wealth and power of King Ahasuerus. And the narrator expects us to connect this to earlier events in the record. He wants us to see that in the process of saving the Jews, the king got richer than he would have. And he was rewarded with a superior rank in the empire, second only to the king, according to verse 3. For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with his many kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people, and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. So the superior rank he was given, that he was great among the Jews, implies, well, for one thing, he was the highest ranking of all Jews in the empire, but that's kind of redundant. If he's second only to the king, he's highest ranking of everybody in the empire, not just the Jews. It would have been impossible for any Jew to be of higher rank than second only to the Persian king. And so I don't think that's the main point that that statement wants to communicate. I think mostly what it wants us to understand is that Mordecai was viewed with great honor and respect by all of his own people. He was considered the greatest among them, not just the most influential or the most powerful in the kingdom, but a great man nationally. He was a national hero. This wasn't just not just ethnic pride and having their one of their own achieve such a rank. It's that the Jews loved Mordecai because of the way he used his position. He didn't use it just to enrich himself. He looked out for their benefit. He looked out for their needs. And they had, and so letter B, gratitude for Mordecai is preserved in the Jewish community. Gratitude for Mordecai is preserved in the Jewish community. Two statements explaining why he was in such favor with his many kinsmen. It says he sought the good of his people and he spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. Now that seems almost redundant. There are two or three things that the aspects that could be considered as points of distinction. It may just mean it may just be two ways of saying the same thing, but there are two or three things that differ between them. First, it's possible to seek something or to desire something that one might be unwilling to speak out in support of, and so. To say that he sought this and he spoke for this are not exactly the same statements. They're similar, but not necessarily identical. The second difference is that the word good and the word welfare are not necessarily synonyms. They're very similar. Again, good is broader. The good of his people would be a very broad in its meaning. It encompasses their well-being, but also encompasses their righteous character. sometimes making them uncomfortable is for their good. We understand that. Sometimes the best thing you can do for your kids is make them uncomfortable when they disobey, right? And sometimes the best thing God could do for Israel was to send them into captivity because they had been rebelling against him. Well, Mordecai was looking out for the good of his people, so it's very broad. But also it says welfare, which is a little more specific. It has more to do with prosperity and security. So there's a little contrast between those two words. There's a third contrast between his people and his whole nation. The word translated nation there is the equivalent of the word that will be translated Gentiles, or frequently translated Gentiles. So it's possible that what he's, and I think it's probable, that there's a slight distinction between the two statements. That he was revered among the Jews because, first of all, he was bringing peace and prosperity to them. His leadership brought peace and prosperity to the Jews. He was seeking the good. He sought the good of his people. But he also spoke for the welfare of the whole nation, his whole nation. And in this sense, his whole nation would be broader than just the Jews because he was Grand Vizier of all of the Persian Empire. And so I think it also means that his leadership brought wealth and security to the empire. He brought wealth and security to the empire, not just the Jews benefited greatly, but the whole empire benefited as a result of Mordecai's leadership. So the book ends with a situation that's actually kind of foreshadowing the blessings of the coming kingdom, with Mordecai foreshadowing the coming king. He's not actually a type of Christ. He's not identified as that, but there are some parallels. He comes from the wrong kingly line, since he's descended from the line of Saul, right? rather than from David. But there are some parallels. The Jews are in this case, they're still scattered throughout the empire. They're still dwelling alongside Gentile converts in many cases. They're living in peace and prosperity without threat of enemy attack. And that's kind of the way it'll be in the kingdom, right? In a temporal sense, at least for now, it's that way. It's not permanent. It's an idyllic scene for sure, but it's destined to be temporary. It's not going to last long. But for right now, the people are rejoicing because they're in a better place than they ever thought they would be under Mordecai's leadership back at the capital. So what we see right here at the conclusion is that this book bears the name of Esther, and she certainly behaved with godly character, with boldness that was critical to the entire narrative. But in the end, it's Mordecai who is extolled for his wisdom, for his guidance. Mordecai is shown to have been a loyal family man. He reared his cousin after the death of her parents. He was a highly placed Persian official who became chief official under the king because he wasn't afraid to do what was right, to stand for the truth, and even to defend the king against an assassination attempt. He was a faithful Jew who secured the deliverance of his people in a seemingly impossible situation. Yeah, Esther was vital to the whole thing for the outworking of everything that was obviously the plan of God, but it was Mordecai's refusal to bow before Haman that was the catalyst for everything, wasn't it? It's easy to read the story and forget just how important Mordecai is to the whole thing, and that's why we really needed to spend some time here on these concluding verses. Esther had attained royalty for such a time as this, but it was Mordecai who recognized that and pointed her toward her duty in all of this. There's a very real sense in which Mordecai should be understood as the key hero in God's deliverance of the people at this time. These lessons, to wrap up this study in Esther, I've got four lessons for us here. First of all, as a reminder here that we see God keeping his promise to Abraham. I've cited Genesis 12:3. That's where God promised Abraham, get up from Ur of the Chaldees, go where I tell you to go. In the process of making him a great nation, he says that he would bless those who bless his descendants. Number one, God will bless those who bless his descendants. Number two, God will curse those who curse his descendants. And number three, through his descendants, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. Is that not exactly what happens in the book of Esther in a small-scale context? Those who blessed the Israelites were blessed. Those who cursed the Israelites were destroyed. And all the people of the kingdom were blessed through the agency of God's people, Israel, in this case. So we see illustrated God keeping his promise to Abraham. This is not the fullness of that, of the keeping of that promise. That's still to come when Christ comes and his salvation of all those who come to him. But this is a foreshadowing of it. Another lesson from this study in Esther is we learn to trust God's guidance. He's in the background. He's invisible in this context, but he's always present. He's always directing. And so we learn to trust him as the guide, the unseen guide. We trust the invisible hand of God, if you will. A third thing I don't want us to miss is we see illustrated for us and an example to us. We learn to act for God's glory as we have an opportunity. You don't know when you'll have an opportunity to act for God's glory. Marvin Brenneman made this point in his commentary. He says, there are a few books of the Old Testament that are more relevant to life in a society hostile to the gospel. Believers are scattered throughout the world awaiting the Lord's return. Although he's present and active now as much as ever, he's usually hidden behind the events of life that he is directing for his own glory and the benefit of his children. End quote. The point being that God has left us here with an opportunity to be his agents, his representative. Who knows but what we may have come to this place for such a time as this. And when we have an opportunity that faces us alone, you yourself, when might you have an opportunity facing you where you could be his representative? Might take special courage. Might just take being alert. You know, you'll never convince unbelievers of the truth by arguing for the truth by itself. I mean, you can't bring them around to recognizing the truth on your own because it's spiritually discerned and they may not have eyes to see. But it's possible that God's going to use you. He may have put this person, this conflict, this opportunity in your path because he expects you to be the one that brings the message of the truth to them so that the Spirit of God can open their eyes to see it. And so we learn from this, from Esther's example, Mordecai's example, that sometimes we just need to lay it on the line and make a difference for Christ. That we may be called upon to do that. the society in which we live is by nature hostile to our faith. They are adversarial toward us and often confrontational. They propose naturalistic, atheistic explanations for everything. They can sound convincing and even intimidating because they use scientific jargon that tries to convince us that they're more intelligent, that they have the answers. Their attacks on our faith are increasingly strident, sometimes vicious, often resembling quite literally the hatred of Haman for God's people. But the writer of Hebrews reminds us in Hebrews 10, verse 13, the exhortation is, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. That's the final lesson. If you don't remember anything else from our study in Esther, don't take any other lesson home from our study in Esther. Take this home. He who promised is faithful. That's the point, that we would remember that he who promised is faithful. He was faithful to the Jews, and he will be faithful to every promise he has ever made for you or for me. Let's pray. Father, we ask that you would remind us daily